This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As an anthropologist and naturopathic doctor, I work with entrepreneurs and go-getters to optimize the health and performance of these world-changing innovators. You don't know anyone like that, do you? Before we jump into today's podcast, I want to thank our sponsor, Legacy. Legacy is an online membership community that provides monthly accountability coaching with a personal health coach and access to lifestyle products at discounts not available to the general public. The neuroscience that connects the benefits of being accountable to another human being and our capacity to stick to goals and commitments is profound. We are sculpted by our commitment and discipline to our daily decisions. Legacy helps that happen. Legacy memberships start at just $22 per month. To learn more, visit legacymemberships.com. Today, I sat down with Dr. Andrew Blackwood. Andrew is a psychotherapist focusing on family and marriage counseling with a particular interest in family of origin and about to write a book or release his book, talking about how to craft the perfect apology. Andrew is one of those people with kind eyes, a warm heart, and a whole lot of wisdom. He is equal parts compassion and call to action. But most, like most skilled therapists, he weaves his advice into this collective narrative of our conversation, mostly without me even knowing it. Our conversation today was no exception. It was full of pure gold, and you are going to love it. Dr. Andrew Blackwood, it is such a pleasure to have you on the Entrepology Podcast.
I'm excited to be here, Dr. Megan.
Well, you and I have had the pleasure of being friends for quite some time now, and I have wanted to have you on the show because I want everyone to have access to this tremendous insight and wisdom that just seems to radiate from you. In any conversation that we've had, you've always just had such a depth of information that you can provide. And I know that's in part from your training. I know it's in part from your background. Can you share your story, where you came from and what compelled you to pursue your work?
Sure. Well, for starters, you're too kind, Megan. You're way too kind. There's no way that I always spout wisdom, but
always.
But you're right. I did have the privilege of going to school and studying marriage and family therapy, and before that, you asked about my story. I am the second eldest of four siblings and born to Jamaican parents. So I'm a first generation Canadian. I grew up going to church and loving that. And I guess I'm just touching base on a couple of things that kind of pull together the fabric of who I am. My parents were divorced when I was 13. And I went away to the U.S. for my first degree in music and came back and continued my studies and back and forth in the States. So why did I pursue this? How did I pursue psychotherapy? Well, the honest truth is people have always seemed to feel comfortable with me and share most meaningful, maybe even secret moments. And I've long been a good listener. I care about people, and I've always been intrigued by the mind. And, you know, I didn't plan this out, to be honest with you. I actually wanted to be a medical doctor and failed chemistry in high school. So those dreams were dashed against the stone. I went into music and had no idea where I would go when I got back. But as life kind of works itself out, and I found my way. I can't really take credit for that, but those things that, you know, were present in my life when I was much younger started to make a whole lot more sense. And, you know, I came across some opportunities and prayerfully kind of making decisions, and here I am.
Amazing. And I think your breadth of background and life experience is part of where so much of your really great information has come from. And, I think that talking about mental health with entrepreneurs is so important. The rates of depression, the rates of anxiety, the incidence of mental health challenges for this particular population are very, very high. And I think in part because there's just so much emphasis on performance and execution. And I think there's a lot of shame for people to actually step back and talk about how they're feeling. That when the opportunity for that conversation to arise takes place, people jump at it. And as I talk to entrepreneurs and I say, you know, what's your biggest source of stress? Inevitably, it's always coming back to these mental health issues. And when we get into it, a lot of the times it's related to family in two ways, either pressure from their parents or their family of origin with respect to decisions that they're making. Either parents are like, you need security. Why are you becoming an entrepreneur? Or I was an entrepreneur and you have to pursue this. And there's just a lot of mixed emotions there. And then also with partners and spouses and families. And how do you balance this all or nothing state that is entrepreneurism with having a healthy relationship? So these are things I really want to delve into with you. And I really want to create the opportunity to open the conversation related to some of these issues. So, you know, to that end, let's just start simple. And I'm kind of interested in your perspective on to what degree does our family of origin dictate our destiny in terms of what we're going to become or do our role in the world?
I definitely think it has an impact. I wouldn't say in most cases, or in any case really, that it dictates. I would definitely say it does inform where we go, what we do, and who we are. So it doesn't create the material, but it does have a hand in shaping it. And I think the biggest thing that we can do, whether we're talking about family of origin or talking about mental health, is increase our awareness and getting some good information, because that can shift the dynamic in your family, whether you're talking about your current family or your family of origin, and even your business and practice.
Right. And so, you know, in talking to my population and in talking to entrepreneurs, a lot of them talk about this as being their calling, right? They're like, I have to do this. Like, I just have this endless supply of ideas and I have to execute on them. But like I mentioned before, there's this struggle, right? With their parents, and their parents are like, come on, like, just, can you do something more secure? And like, and I get the struggle back and forth. And I know that, certainly a lot of the individuals that I'm speaking to are like, I sincerely struggle with this. What kind of advice would you provide them, either in how to open a dialogue or really how to move towards a psychology where they're strengthening that sense of self and confidence in where they feel they should go?
Bouncing back to the whole awareness piece, there is the reality of self-awareness and how important that is, but then there's also the awareness of your family and their family history. Where is this pressure coming from?
Right.
You know, sometimes it's genuine care and concern about the future, which is actually wise. There's a lot of wisdom that we can get from our parents and, you know, family members and spouses. But then sometimes along with that wisdom, or in place of it, or in the guise of that wisdom, is anxiety from their life and their life story. So if we're unaware of what that story is and how it plays out, then we might not be able to tell the difference.
People have consistently said to me, you know, it's, you have to assume that it's not always about you, that it's often about their story. And I feel like that's what you're alluding to.
Yeah, most definitely. And so it's really great when we can have those clear conversations. You know, what is this really about? Are you anxious? Are you feeling anxious? Are you concerned? Do you have a specific concern that we can address? Because often we can address this together. And that's one of the, there's a big difference between worry and concern, whether you're speaking from an individual perspective or from, you know, a family perspective. Worry is basically spinning your wheels and not going anywhere. You're having these negative pictures and predictions, whereas concern, you can really develop a concrete plan because there are some legitimate aspects of the concern that you are not in control of, but then there are parts that you are in control of.
Right. And it's funny because even as you were mentioning, considering where they came from, and this is a totally different discussion, which I think warrants a completely different episode. But, you know, there's increasing research now looking at, you know, historical family trauma, wars, famines, looking at immigrants, and how that actually imprints on your DNA. So sometimes people's concern or apprehension or anxiety about, you know, the path of their offspring, as it were, to like bring it back totally to genetics, I think can sometimes come from those places, as well. Like, at what point do we really start to evolve into having this autonomous sense of self, meaning moving away from this need? And I know people who are in their 50s who are still engaging in this need to please our parents. How do we flip that psychology?
Wow. Well, you know, my approach, because I have the opportunity to meet with so many people, it's affirmed that I have guidelines in my work. I don't have rules. So very rarely is it just one thing or one way to approach a situation. But I definitely think there are some common things that are at play for most people. So autonomous self, you know, that's another way to kind of think about the process of individuation. How do you become an individual? And sometimes that happens for people, ideally, throughout various phases of their lives. So, you know, you see it in your teen years. You see it when, you know, you're wanting to spend more time with your friends, or you change friend groups, or sometimes it's having conflict with your parents, even for the sake of having conflict.
I know nothing about that.
Oh, really?
Nope, not at all.
Right. So some people, they either skip that era of life or suppress it, and then they find themselves doing it in their 20s or their 30s or their 40s or their 50s or never, unfortunately.
Wait, when you say unfortunately, like, should we rebel against our parents? Is that actually normal?
Well,
normal's in quotations, but no one can see me.
You know what? I think conflict can be healthy. Rebellion, I think sometimes can be appropriate. If you are being oppressed and abused, it makes sense to rebel. But conflict doesn't necessarily have to be hurtful and disrespectful.
Okay, good point.
Parents are anticipating this and they're making room for it. They will acknowledge, okay, you're an individual and you can make your own choices. We want you to be safe. This is what we want to encourage you to look out for. But some people are not prepared to do that, not informed enough to do that. And some people are not receptive of that and they want to do their own thing when they want to do it. So sometimes that individuation process can be complicated even by this self-willed, strong-willed person.
You know, I'm half joking when I said I never had that rebellious streak. I don't think I ever engaged in that disrespectful piece, but I feel like, you know, building your own business and doing your own thing, I feel like those are opportunities to kind of rebel against established norms. And I think for a lot of people pursuing entrepreneurism, that's the way that it manifests for them. And maybe many people are rolling their eyes like, no, I like seriously rebelled when I was a teenager. And I'm curious too, you know, maybe this is a function of being the oldest child and it's sometimes the only child because my parents are divorced. Does birth order matter?
Does it matter? I think it can play a strong role, but just like we were talking about the family of origin, does it dictate? It doesn't dictate anything. It really depends on the context. So you talked about the eldest child, which might, you know, be the only child, but sometimes, depending on the family dynamic, the family setup, as you know, there are so many different experiences of family. There's a blended family, there's the, you know, and then you factor in family history. So you factor in culture, you factor in ethnicity, then you factor in the story of a particular family, if there is trauma or if there is abuse or if there is, you know, mental health or developmental, you know, challenges. Birth order really might not have that much of a significant role in determining who that individual becomes. I was the second born, like I mentioned earlier, but, you know, my brother, he is an amazing graphic artist. And, you could see his artistry even as a child. But coming from Jamaican West Indian parentage, there wasn't necessarily an appreciation for that that type of personality. Whereas I was, you know, in my younger years, the more straight-laced kind of linear thinking. And then because I was a second child, I also learned from my brother's mistakes. So for a period of time, I was inducted into the role of being the eldest child. I was the second born, but I was in effect the eldest because I was more, you know, I remembered certain things that my brother didn't. So birth order in that essence really didn't play so much of a role in who I am. In fact, the fact that I was second born and then inducted into the role of the first or the eldest, that had more of a impact on my development than being born second. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. Do you see in your practice, though, certain trends with individuals, you know, the firstborn, the middle versus the youngest? Like moving from the theoretical to like just in general, when you are working with people, do you see that?
I do. And you see it more play out in terms of the relational dynamic. So, you know, the middle born is the one who, depending on the gap, you know, the age gaps between their siblings, they're the one who's typically more able to share, or they're the one who is more inclined to keep the peace. The youngest one is usually the one who might be a little bit more expectant of help or support. Or alternatively, they might be the one who rejects support because they are tired of being babied. So you do see some of those dynamics, but most of the times when people share about, you know, particularly the things that were hurtful or harmful, they have more to do with the other aspects of family life.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, as I was looking at the literature with respect to birth order and entrepreneurs, it was very divided by culture. So, you know, there was a study out of Hong Kong where they were looking at firstborn children having a higher propensity towards entrepreneurism, but that was not seen in other cultures. So, you know, I think you're right, Dr. Blackwood. It totally depends on all of these different factors. But I think, you know, especially in a Western context, we're used to hearing certain things. I think we actually find it interesting, right, to think that maybe our birth order dictates our destiny a little bit, but maybe relieving to some people that it doesn't.
Yeah, I definitely think there are a lot of characteristics that really help entrepreneurs forge their own direction or blaze their own path. And I think it has a lot to do with their ability to take risks, right? Which can be informed by family, can be informed by culture. But a large part, I think, of what you talked about, the call, I think that has a lot to do with their individual values and the constellation of those values that are core to them. Now, sometimes those values may be shared with their parents or their siblings, and other times in direct conflict with them. For example, an entrepreneur might be driven by the value for making a difference or achievement or success or even security or even independence. It can vary from one person to the next. And if a family has a strong value of, let's say, family, right? We do everything as a family. This is the family business, right? You're part of the family, family, family. But this person has a core value for independence. A lot of people don't know what their core values are and don't realize those core values will put them in a position for either success or intense conflict.
Okay, so that brings up a really good point. And you say that you know, a lot of people don't know what those core values are. And, you know, the entrepreneurial ride is, it's a roller coaster. It can sometimes the drop feels long or the climb feels really steep. Should we all be in therapy?
Yes.
Biased response.
For sure. Well, even before thinking about having whether it's a private practice or going into the field, I was always, like I said, curious about the mind. And the reality is that everyone needs and benefits from support, whether that support is formal or informal. We all need people. So, I mean, there's a big difference between having therapy and having therapeutic conversations. So I think there are times and seasons in everyone's life when they can benefit from therapy, but that's not necessarily a constant, and that's not necessarily accessible for everyone. So it's important to be able to identify who are the people in your life where you actually have therapeutic relationships, where, you know, the relationships are respectful, they're open, they're honest, and they're supportive, and they're empowering. But yet they can hold you accountable. They can challenge you, not hold you accountable, but invite you into accountability, and vice versa. There's that, you know, back and forth where it's 50-50, those kinds of relationships, and they're vital.
Right. And it kind of reminds me of, you know, a tool I think a lot of entrepreneurs use, which is a mastermind, where you've got a group of like-minded individuals. There's an immense respect for confidentiality and an opportunity for openness. And I think a good mastermind is a great tool for a lot of people. And I really liked what you said, too, about the concept of therapy versus therapeutic conversations. And, you know, one of the areas where I think having either advice on or an opportunity to engage in a really constructive dialogue is with our partners. So, you know, again, from that entrepreneurial perspective, when you are in it and you are focused on your business and you're just without hesitation pulling these 60-hour weeks and sort of dropping all else, there's this huge burden that gets passed on to onto your family and your partners. I guess it's two parts. One, like, how do we constructively honor that, because it feels like nothing is really ever enough. Like, that people really are picking up a huge burden on our behalf. And then I guess the second piece is, you know, how do we help them to understand a dedication to the calling?
You know, I think it makes a big difference when people know what they're signing up for.
Right.
So them having a good picture at the beginning, which isn't always the case. Sometimes you find yourself unable to continue in the, for lack of a better word, the rat race, you know, working for someone else and, you know, not pursuing your passion and not finding enough life-giving energy in those roles. So you switch and you start to pursue your own dreams. So if your partner isn't anticipating that and they don't know what to expect, it would be important to have a series of conversations about what that means so that we can really give them good information as much as we have, but then we can also get their feedback about what their needs are and what their dreams are, because if they had certain expectations about how, you know, married life would be and what family life would be, and then you change that whole picture, that can be terribly problematic, depressing, upsetting. You know, even a sense of betrayal and loss can be birthed without going through a process together.
Right. So conversations being super key. And I'm hearing you say that really the management of those expectations being at the forefront of that dialogue.
Yeah, because if people aren't explicit about what their expectations are, or explicit, you know, and it goes both ways, what you will now be asking of your partner, you know, how long will you be away? And, you know, what does your partner need from you? So that it's not just a one-sided kind of pursuit of either dream.
Yeah, I think that's a really key point there. And that one question, right? Like, what do you need from me as the entrepreneur and as your partner to be able to pursue what I'm pursuing, but still honor the relationship?
Right.
And that is, you know, that's all great in theory. And sometimes you just have to practice that. It takes people outside of that place of ego. It means there's going to be a little bit of compromise. And, you know, and I think one of the things that frequently happens is that there's a lot of apologies, right? And I think that needs to happen. And I put that in there because I wanted to segue and talk about this concept of apology, not because I'm not going to heed your advice and have these strategic conversations. I've realized as I've gotten a little bit older, how important it is when I feel wronged or feel that something is unfair to just hear I'm sorry. And then I can kind of erase everything and move on. Can you talk to us about your research into, I'm going to call it the perfect apology and the book that you're working on right now?
Yeah, the book is, it's about the art of a genuine apology. And, you know, there's a lot to it. At first, when I started working on it, it was developed out of some tools that I've been using with clients for years, just on basically how to avoid ruining an apology, because it can be really powerful, but it can also be really harmful if you don't do it well. And the more thought that I gave to it, and when I tried to kind of write it down and simplify it, it just brought up a host of other things. So I wanted to put that, I'm putting it together in book form so that people can have some good information. But I agree with you that a healthy, meaningful apology can free people up to move past situations and even heal emotional injury that, you know, has been there for even quite some time.
And what constitutes an apology based in integrity?
Integrity is really, that's one of my core values, by the way, because that has everything to do with honesty and strength and dependability. So if there isn't that sense of honesty going into the apology, is the apology sincere? If you are lacking sincerity, or if it's compromised and not addressed, then it's going to do more damage than good to both parties. Then the whole part of dependability has a lot to do with what happens after you apologize, which can throw even the most sincerest of apologies out the window. Because saying sorry for something and then going back and doing the same thing, it's worse than never having apologized at all.
Right. And it's so interesting that you're talking about this because, you know, one of the things I would do in my practice is a lot of genetic testing. And we would look at propensities to make serotonin or make dopamine or any of these different elements. And it's really interesting because there's a very distinct genetic profile of people who don't carry the scars of interactions or the scars of failures. They can really very much like integrate it and let it go. Their physiology is not designed to hang on to it. But for other people, they do hang on to it. And you know, as you are describing the sincerity of the apology, I'm viewing it through this lens of neurotransmitters. And there's going to be those people who can just let it go because they can do it. But they're still going to need that trigger that takes them from that immediate emotional place to that inherent genetic environment that allows them to do that. And I think that's what you're getting at. Like, it's so interesting as we're sitting here to have the psychology melding with the genetics and the neurotransmitters and all of those pieces. But at the end of the day, it's such a critical skill in life, right? To be able to offer that to people. And it's a gift to be able to offer that to people.
Right. Most definitely. Whether it's difficult or easy to move on, I do think providing the venue and the guidance for how to do that. Because if one partner, you know, has a genetic profile that makes it easy for them and the other partner doesn't, how do you meet in the middle? And, you know, are we speaking the same language? And, you know, it's important for every relationship to really master the basics. I mean, something you would learn in kindergarten, you know, let's take turns, right? When you think about it, everyone has a perspective, but do both sides get heard? And how do we do that in a way that, you know, doesn't vilify or demonize one person and, you know, make the other person out to be some sort of angel? So finding the middle ground does require that kind of understanding and the ability to listen and the ability to engage. Some people want to take the short route and, you know, I'm sorry is good enough, right? I don't need to be specific about what I'm sorry for, or I don't need to mention what I did in the past. Why are you bringing up the past and all this kinds of stuff? So I think the elements of a good apology actually do require enough specificity about what the hurting party has endured. Without that, then there's no real way to convey that I appreciate what you experienced, and, you know, it matters to me how you're feeling. That's a whole nother conversation, you know, aside from I was wrong for doing what I did.
Well, and I think that's the key right there, what you just said, it being able to convey that it matters to me how you are feeling. And I'm reading a book on negotiation right now, and it was like, at the end of the day, you need to have empathy for the person sitting across from you. And if they feel like they are understood and you understand how they're feeling, then that completely shifts where a negotiation is going to go. I think it's so exciting, and I can't wait to read this book and gift it to significant people in my life. I've got a quick question for you. How do you define health?
In the realm of relationships, I think health is intrinsically connected to growth. And it's, for lack of a better way to say it, it's contagious. It's inspiring. It's informative. It's influential. So if you are growing, and if you are inspiring and encouraging and supporting growth in other people, I would definitely say that that's healthy.
I love that. I really love it. Each month, I'm featuring a new Anthropology quiz to help you unlock and uncover some of the physical performance blocks that may be holding you back from your true potential. This month, we are talking about stress and adrenal fatigue. To learn more or to take the quiz, head on over to meganwalker.com/Anthropology quiz. Andrew, we're going to take, we're going to segue into that second half of the interview that we talked about, where we're looking at those key performance indicators. And so these are things that you have not been prepared for, but they're also not difficult. But I wanted your raw first impression of these different topics. So here's the first question. Do you have a consistent morning routine? If so, spill it.
I do, at least I try to make it consistent with a 3.5 and 6 month old children. But my morning routine includes waking up to my alarm at about 6 o'clock, doing some push-ups, and having some devotional time, quiet time, journaling, praying, and then getting my 3.5-year-old up and getting her ready and having breakfast and taking her to school. That's my morning routine. And then I try to get to the gym.
Good for you. I like that. Get your blood flowing and then some time with your kids, which is so nice. Fiction or nonfiction?
Nonfiction.
What are you reading right now?
I just finished one. Actually, it's the Dave Ramsey's Money Makeover.
Okay. I like it. What's your hot beverage of choice? And how do you prepare it?
I'm not much of a hot beverage person, but when I'm preparing my own, it's orange pico with almond milk and brown sugar. But I also enjoy the hot apple cider from Starbucks.
Oh, yeah. Good call. What do you do for fun?
Hang out with my friends, watch TV with my family, listen to music and dance.
And last question, entrepreneurism. Are we born this way or do people learn to become entrepreneurs?
Ooh, I would say both. Not everyone who is an entrepreneur becomes an entrepreneur.
Right.
So you could have it innately within you and never access it. So I think even the best of entrepreneurs out there learned along the way to turn natural ability and talent into skill.
Yeah, I find this question so interesting, and I'm trying not to pipe in here on it. It's fascinating to me. I find that people's answers are often sculpted by their experience with entrepreneurism, which is so nice, because what it says to anybody who feels they have this calling is that it doesn't really matter what your background is. It doesn't matter what the research says. It doesn't matter any of those things. If this is what you feel compelled to do and you're driven to do it, you're going to find a way to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew, Dr. Blackwood, like always, it is such a pleasure to be able to hang out with you and hear what you have to say and your profound perspectives. And there were just so many gems in this conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to hang out with us.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Megan. I loved it. It was great.
Amazing. And if people want to learn more about what you are up to or where they can hear more about your work, where can they find you?
They can find me at www.coachdrew.ca. And I also see people at Dr. Karen Gordon's leadership studio in Toronto. So www.dkleadership.org. You can find me there too.
Amazing. Thank you so much, and have a fantastic day.
I will. You too.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Entrepology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.